Why do you hurt the one who treats you so good? And why do we only act the way others think we should?
I can't help thinking of when I have, for example, taken off the top of a termite hill and I've seen termites in there. All busying about building walls, looking after the queen, caring for the pupae, clearing the nest, and, all busy about it. Then they're all blind, and they haven't the faintest idea that I am there watching what they're doing, because they don't have those sense organs which would allow them to know that. And I do sometimes feel that maybe I'm lacking in some sense organ. I don't know whether there's anybody else involved in all this sort of thing. And it's a very confident thing to say that I'm absolutely sure that there's nothing in this world that I don't have the sense organs to appreciate. That would be my position. And Richard, I don't doubt, would say, well, that's rather feeble. That's not being very brave. And he maybe has got a case.
Thing about you. Thing about you.
And a hard future in an overcrowded job market. Submitted to your approval to the Midnight Society, I bring you the tale of the precariat.
Hello and welcome to another week of Graduates Anonymous. I'm your host, Terrence, and I'm joined by my co-host, Naomi.
Well, are you going to do that the whole time? I think that'd be good. I think if you could keep that up.
The entire time. This is my terrible Dracula impersonation.
I was going to say, it kind of sounds like you've aged like 30, 40, 50 years.
Hello, I am 80.
Graduates Anonymous. We're a collection of informed and elderly folks just trying to get our educations.
When I was your age, I used to walk uphill both ways, and I don't even... Now it's you get to ride your bicycle to school, and it's everything is fine, and I don't understand what you're complaining about.
I did bike in the snow. And slash rain this morning, to be fair.
That's true, because you're a survivor. You're not gonna give up. You're not gonna stop. You gonna work harder. In any case, welcome to another episode of Graduates Anonymous, our graduate school talk show. And today we're gonna get into some interesting topics, as sort of alluded to by our ominous intro. We're going to have a discussion about a very necessary conversation in the sort of graduate school environment in academia. It addresses the entirety of academia, looks it in the face, and says, "Hey, I see you, and we're going to change you." But we'll begin as we usually do with the recap of our week, Naomi.
Yeah, let's see. I had a really nice dinner with a friend of mine who I haven't seen in a number of years, or I just recently reconnected with her. We realized we live in the same city. That's weird. And she has a beautiful apartment and fed me some beautiful food. And I met her beautiful roommates, and that was really fun. And then my other fun story, not fun, I don't know, interesting. I was like sweeping off our porch, and I just have like this little handheld broom, and I like grated my knuckles against the concrete. So I had these bloody knuckles for a couple days, and I felt kind of cool and like powerful, and I like I had beaten someone up or something. But then
violent.
I realized, well, I'm not, but you know, cultural norms are, you know, osmosed.
Sure.
But then I realized it would be the wrong knuckles. Like I would have sort of had to gently whap someone with the ends of my fingers, and that wouldn't have been probably very effective.
So they're not the sort of primary sort of joint, sort of wrist or palm to finger knuckles, but they have the sort of mid finger bend knuckles.
Right.
So you'd have had to do like a weird, like sort of Tyrannosaurus Rex punch, like a
exactly. That was probably about as good as that visual, very visual situation could be for an audio audience.
Hey, listen, I am a. And I try to be a wordsmith and paint pictures with nouns and adjectives and subjectives and adjectives. Yeah, I'm doing this game and I'm mad with it. Yeah, you like my rapping skills? Out of it. That's
wonderful.
Like.
That was beautiful. But how was your week?
My week has been, oh man, I feel like there's just some top secret stuff I can't talk about.
That's
my week.
That's so true. Oh, my excited voice came out.
We talked about this. Never right. The, so I've had an eventful week, but for reasons I cannot disclose at this stage, although I will be able to talk about them next week.
I'm so excited.
Stay tuned next week to
find out. Do you have anything that's declassified? Or maybe because you're the leader of the country, you could just tell me, because whenever you say things, it just becomes unclassified.
That's true. As the
not
president
topical.
Of the United States of the United States of America, did I say United States twice? As the president of the
you can
US,
do what you want.
I really like anything I say is not classified, just because I'm the president. It's sort of like this idea, I can't break any laws, I mean, whatever. It's neither here nor there. I mean, we all know as your supreme leader that, I'm always right. So as long as you, the listener, knows that, then everything will be just fine. So declassified information, I would say, not really anything super great because I've been very busy, but I've been very busy with some of the sort of logistical, infrastructural sort of things that are part of this big plan that I have for, what I'm going to do after I finish this last grueling week of, gearing up for finals and writing papers and things like that. I got to say, though, it's always the hardest to get the first draft done, like you do the lit review or you do any of your sort of background searching, any of that sort of materials, idea gathering, and then it's always just this uphill battle to get everything down into a piece of paper with your citations in place and then to send it off as your first draft. Beyond that, you're like tweaking and you hit some roadblocks, as you struggle.
Yeah, but it just having the basic infrastructure there, it's like, oof.
I know.
Yeah.
Sometimes I just feel like I just need to get better at just putting just like a word vomit onto a page and then coming back later and editing it, as opposed to trying to be so intentional about, well, how do I like craft this thing from point A to point B to point Z and then get all of it out there. And so I always approach my first draft as like, I want it to be so good that you're like, so this doesn't need any improvement. I guess we'll just submit it as
it is. Yeah, but that's kind of the, like, if you've submitted it when it's that good, you've submitted too late.
That's true.
That's true. But this week we have a question, and I think it's my chance to read the question.
Yeah, so I'm really excited about. In a totally normal voice, you probably
I'm just gonna represent the essence of this person's experience and what they are bringing to us.
Oh, interesting.
So this is from Bod 31681. I have an embarrassingly low GPA. I have a 3.135. I'm going to be retaking a course in the summertime that I got a C in, and I'll be retaking another course next semester. And during my second year of school, I have to mention I got really ill. I had severe health issues, in addition to having really bad personal issues. So I really want to get into grad school more than anything, and I would be happy for any advice you would give me.
Next week's episode, cultural appropriation. But this week, let's answer the question about GPA.
The real problem is cultural commodification.
Hey, that's
we'll talk about that at some point.
Okay, damn. Nice retort. Not cultural proprio, but a cultural modico.
Oui, et je parle français, donc je peux l'utiliser, la langue.
Oh, parlez-vous français?
Oui. I just said I speak French, so I can use the language and the accent.
I'm asking you, I'm like, do you actually speak French? Okay, in any case, so this person is curious. They've got a 3.135, right? And they are retaking classes.
Which would bump your GPA up.
And not by a lot, though. By the time that you are about to graduate, realistically speaking, retaking, let's say, a D and transforming it to an A probably raises your GPA by not that much altogether. I mean, it's like changing one of the numbers in an average when the average is made up of, like, you know, 35, 40 numbers, right?
Our podcast is now just explaining basic math.
I mean, it's true.
I mean, but you know, you're right. It's just relative.
Yeah.
So I think, I mean, you're doing really good steps, Bod.
Bod.
Mademoiselle Bod. And I think that, you know, you have perfectly legitimate reasons for having some challenging times in school. And even people who just have hard times with school, like, that's also a legitimate reason, you know? Like, you don't have to have extenuating circumstances. But I will say that most applications have, like, a special section where you can kind of explain things that you feel are a little bumpy in your applications.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you can even integrate sort of your personal experience and,
yeah.
Maybe that's related to the field you want to go into or what you specifically want to study. And so you could put things like that in your personal statement, right. Or it could just be this auxiliary kind of explanatory bit.
I mean, this will roll right into our main topic, but I mean, really think about why it's important to you to have a 4.0 or to have a high GPA, right? It's because that when we think about what it takes to get into graduate school, we're often thinking about what it takes to get into the most competitive university where the quote unquote best students are applying. So if you want to go to an Ivy League, then anything short of a 4.0 with 100 hours of community service and a CV that includes publications and glowing letters of recommendation from the dean and the provost, da da da, like, you know, this notion that your value as a student can be measured by a number or any collection of numbers is a fallacy. And I'll say, as someone who graduated from my undergrad with a 3.1, I still was able to get into half the graduate schools I applied to, which is highly unusual. I'm also a student of color. I also published 2 and had 1 paper in press by the time that I finished as a senior in my undergraduate. And I'd also been to conferences and given talks and da-da-da. So, you know, for me, the experience was a big part of my graduate application. And I think that helped me cross the finish line. In addition to being able to talk about my ideas and being excited about research, given that I'm trying to go into a scientific field. But I'd say that, you know, think about where you want to go to graduate school and what you want to do, and really think about whether your GPA is the most important part of that sort of application process, because you might be wasting your time taking an extra class sort of bring your C up to an A. If, for example, maybe the school that you're really in love with is, you know, a smaller university that is located outside of a major city, and you have been in touch with some of the faculty, you know, there's an entire table at SPSP, a conference that I've gone to a number of times, and it's an entire table for faculty and graduate students from small graduate universities, usually with, like, graduate student populations of, like, 10 or less, you know, in the entire department. Not a great fit for everybody, but let's not pretend that those schools aren't also places where scholarship is produced and where, you know, intelligence is shared and da da da. So, you know, GPA is important. And I would say, you know, don't fail all of your classes. You know, it provides some relative estimate of, the, you know, what you take away from those courses. But, you know, I wouldn't get bummed out by a low GPA. I mean, especially given that 3.13 is not a low, low GPA. I think you can still get into graduate school, something like that. And also, maybe not Harvard, right? But do you want to go to Harvard? And I think that,
you know. I think that's a good summary. And I think just in general, remembering that your application is kind of this whole package and you know, the different facets, you know, you can kind of make up with them.
Yeah. Don't be one of those people who doesn't study for the GRE. Okay. Don't engage in that, like, self-defeating stuff. If you're like a G and you can kill it and you just know it. But I've had friends who have, like I said, oh, I'm going to study. I'm taking the GRE next year. It's going to be a big deal. I'm super nervous about it. And they allow the sort of nervousness or the anxiety about how difficult it's going to be to prevent them from really preparing to take the test. And they take it and don't do very well and have a more difficult time getting into places, because GRE is surprisingly something that people pay a lot of attention to, I've noticed in that.
Well, I think it's just a nice, not nice, it's kind of gross, but it's a first round heuristic of, like, right. If you don't meet X criteria, then you're kind of right. In the, probably out of the pile.
Yeah, because I think that they look at they say that like GPA doesn't necessarily predict graduate school success. I think that the research shows that it predicts at best sort of your first year grades, but that the GRE is a more reliable indicator of overall graduate school success. And I've had friends who are way smarter than me and have had way higher GPAs than I did, but they were like, oh, I got the GRE, didn't study for it. And then when it actually came time for us to take it and we got our results back, it was like, oh, well, I did better in certain sections and better overall, because I killed myself studying for like months and months with taking flashcards to work and doing math problems and da da da. In large part because I wanted to, like, I knew that I was going to, like, for the whole package, as Naomi mentioned earlier, I knew that the GRE package would be a big part of it.
I'm a child. yeah, we should have, like, a GRE-specific thing sometime, but we can do that later. But you know what's happening right now?
What's that?
Both the NBA playoffs and, coincidentally, Baller Scholarship on Graduates Anonymous.
I feel like I'm going to come up with a... like one of those like NBA Jam sort of like, what is the basketball tournament that happens called?
The playoffs?
Yes, like a sort of playoff theme song. Like,
y'all ready for this? Baller Scholarship!
Yeah, I think so. I think I'm going to figure out some like hyphy in the club sort of theme song for this.
I mean, I wouldn't be opposed.
Which people just get totally thrown off. They're like, oh, they're just talking about GREs. And then like,
yes,
like just gangster rap comes on.
We want to be cool.
So what's our Baller Scholarship for this week?
Well, I remember that library science is a thing. And so I found a really cool journal.
Shout out to all the library scientists.
Yes, the journal is called Library and Information Science Research. Thank you, the internet. And basically, so we found this, I think, pretty cool and relevant to our conversation today and to our lives. Article, it's titled Research Data Management Services in Academic Research Libraries and Perceptions of Librarians.
Great.
By Carol Tenopier, Robert Sandusky, Susie Allard and Ben Birch. And just quick recap, basically there's some really cool kind of innovative work being done with research data management services, kind of in light of that more research is being done collaboratively across many universities, and that poses kind of challenges, A, for the size of databases that are being collected, and B, sharing it sort of safely and securely and maintaining confidentiality across institutions. So this was kind of this really pretty robust analysis of what services are available currently within universities that librarians offer, and librarians and their sort of supervisors' perception of where the future of the field is going. So it's a cool article. It's available for free. That's another kind of one of my pet peeves, is that so much academic research is behind paywalls.
Right.
But this was nice. This was just open to the world, so you can go check it out.
Yeah, and it's this whole like data management research data management. Can I speak English today? I've stumbled over all of
you can speak French.
I cannot. I'm not a French speaker, although I know a bit of Korean, incidentally. But the from living there, not because I'm some kind of weirdo who's obsessed with Korean people. I lived there for 3 years.
Are you just defending your knowledge of Korean right now?
I just get self-conscious. It's like, I know that people have fetishized other cultures. And so whether it's like, ooh, I want to learn French, or I want to learn Haitian Creole, or I want to learn da-da-da, it's sort of like, you know, I always feel like I need to sort of take a step back and say, like, hey, I lived there.
I earned it.
For a long time, for 3.5 years.
You had a Korean girlfriend, didn't you?
It's my first girlfriend in my entire life.
Whoa.
Learned how to read and write and speak, and I have since, much of that is drained out of my brain. But the important thing is, it's coming from a real place. In any case, my feedback about this article is that I think that if librarians are saying we need more research data management services, then we should probably have more research data management services. These are the people who we are often the most taken for granted, I've been in several undergraduate classes where the librarian has come in and said, like, hey, here's how you guys get access to articles. Here's some really helpful tools to do Boolean searches. Here's why we're here to do these things. We're excited to help you guys out, get you the articles you need, answer any questions that you have. Like, we know our stuff. We engage with the stuff. We really care about the stuff. We're like active actively pushing to make more stuff available for you. And but then, you know, people don't go to the library or forget that they take for granted that when they log into library.yourinstitution.edu, that they can just keyword search the title of an article and it'll pop up, you know, and that infrastructure is being supported and provided by someone, and it's not you or the faculty that you work for. It's the librarians. So.
Yeah. Well, and you know, you're not, we can't all be experts in everything. So if you can shop out certain things to somebody who's got the time and energy to dedicate that and the expertise, then that's awesome. So,
and they're great resources too for like writing. I mean, in terms of like trying to work through, an idea, saying like, well, I have this particular topic area and I'm having a hard time finding articles related to this topic area. They're great people to go. I mean, I don't want to turn this into sort of like,
we love librarians,
a lecture about library services, but yo, shouts out to librarians all across the country. We appreciate your work. You really are the backbone to what most people consider to be independent work in academia, which I think rolls really nicely on into our topic. So shall we, after the doors continue to creep?
We've got some, in line with our spooky, scary intro, we've got some scary doors opening and closing.
Can you hear the bat sounds in the background? Be afraid. Okay.
Scooby.
So this is a very meaty discussion, but we thought it would be important to, at the top, number one, give you an overview of what exactly we're talking about, and then define some of the terms, because we think that if you're not familiar with this kind of discourse, then some of these terms and how they apply might be unfamiliar to you. So we're going to go through and give you a bit of a primer on this discussion. So Naomi, what's the overview?
Yeah, so we're basically having a discussion based on a really brilliant article by a fellow PhD candidate. He's also an instructor in history and comparative literature. That's what he's studying as well at University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. His name is Maximilian Alvarez. And this piece is called Contingent No More. And it was published in The Baffler, which we'll link to, obviously, all of that. And so basically just to kind of general, the abstract, if you will, of this piece. So basically, first, academia is in crisis. Based on kind of this larger trajectory of capitalism being in crisis. And that in combination with that and the fact that academics kind of hold particular myths about the ways in which we have to work and approach our work and our lives, as well as these kind of very idealistic reasons that people go into academia, all three of these factors combine to make the academic labor force really just primed for exploitation in you know, unique ways that are potentially different from other facets of the labor force. So given all of these factors, Alvarez makes a pretty strong call to action, I feel. And we'll get into all of that in more depth as we go through, but that's just kind of the broad overview. Do you want to talk about some of these definitions, Terrence?
Yeah, absolutely. So we all have an understanding of what liberalism is, right? However, neoliberalism is something that gets discussed in this article. Oh, my goodness.
It's dumping snow out there.
I know. Sorry. I just looked out the window and I'm like, what month is it currently? Oh, it's May. Great. Looking forward to more snow, I guess. Sorry, folks. Distracted by the weather outside.
But back to neoliberalism.
back to neoliberalism. So so neoliberalism is essentially this resurgence of this idea that it's a belief in the free market. If you leave the market to its own devices, everything will be awesome. It's about the fairness of the market and that people, consumers, will ultimately dictate the sort of prices and the sort of demand and supply that makes up the currency or the sort of the flow of a market, right? And a market being anything where these goods and services are traded, whether it's your time as a graduate student or whether it's a product like your iPhone or anything else, okay? So the second idea is something about contingent faculty. So these two words, I think on their own, we all are somewhat familiar with. If you put them together, the definition is also fairly intuitive. Contingent faculty are just those faculty who essentially don't have guaranteed work. They don't have job security. So when we think of part-time faculty, like adjunct faculty or guest lecturers and things like that, they all make up what's called contingent faculty. And the jobs that are available for contingent faculty are increasing as the availability of tenure-track jobs, the more permanent jobs, are decreasing. Their common characteristic is that their institutions make no long or make little to or no long-term commitment to them. So when we talk about them, just know that we're talking about faculty who don't have a lot of job security in short.
And I'll add that we'll link to it as well, but Alvarez links and his piece to this wonderful sort of confessional article in the New Yorker of a woman who went on to go be a writer, but as an undergrad had an amazing professor who she at the time didn't realize was an adjunct.
Yeah.
And I would encourage undergrads, you know, current undergrads who are listening, to kind of be inquisitive about the positions that their current teachers hold, because you may not know that your teachers you love and are good teachers are in this really precarious situation, which brings us to the next term we wanted to define.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it's important to linger on that point because what you essentially have is the people who are responsible for your education, they're effectively mercenaries, right? Mm-hmm. And the problem with that is that the incentive for really sort of digging your heels in and investing in your students is relatively low when you don't have job security, you know? So if you have a class that's particularly tough and you want some of that teacher's extra time in order for mentorship or whatever it is, like, that teacher may or may not be available because, you know, they're working two other teaching positions at local schools, or they are on a sort of 4 or 5 teaching schedule, so they have a load of classes larger than a full-time faculty member, and you know, don't have the availability, nor does it make sense for them to sort of, in addition to staying up till midnight preparing lectures and everything else, you know, provide mentorship and tutoring services off to the side. So, you know, it is something that can be really detrimental to our outcome as those interested in receiving a quality education. And finally, the sort of big term in the title of this tale introduced by the Midnight Society is precariat. And precariat is ostensibly a social class formed by people who suffer from precarity, which I know that you love when we use the word in its own definition. So we'll say that that's just a condition of existence without predictability or security. And it's, you know, purported to have effects on material and psychological welfare. And it's a sort of a contrast, if you will, to the proletariat class of industrial workers from the 20th century who lacked the means of production. The guy standing, an economist and professor at the University of London and author of a book called The Precariat Charter, from Denizens to Citizens, suggests in his book that 40 to 45% of the labor force in many countries is made up of precariat labor work. And so what are some examples of precariat labor?
Well, you can kind of just think of anything where you probably don't have benefits. There's no sort of consistent, you don't know, you have some sort of short-term contract or maybe no contract at all, but like a temp or as with these contingent faculty, they right. are, you know, kind of on this term-by-term basis. But if they speak out, if they do anything to rock the boat, you could potentially be fired. So right. A lot of low-level service employees kind of fall under this boat.
I mean, and think about the guys, like, for example, as your Lyft driver or Uber driver who right. don't have any kind of insurance or anything like that. So if their car gets hit, they're out of a job, or they're at the very least unavailable to or unable to sort of make more money until they can sort of arrange other options, whether it's renting a car through their car rental service. But ostensibly, like, no one is sort of there at the end of the day sort of saying, well, this is your job and you have this job and you're on this contract, da, da, da. And a lot of states have laws in place. For example, Maryland, one of the states I lived in, has an at-will employment law, which means that they can fire you at any time for any reason. So for many people entering into the labor force for some of these entry-level or low-level jobs, whether it's data analysis, whether it's a server at a restaurant, whether it's a graphic designer, there's no sort of sense of long-term job security that comes along with those promises. And your employers are free to, you know, cut the sort of tie that binds you whenever they please, for whatever reason that they please, which can contribute to discriminatory hiring and firing practices. So
all that really leads well into kind of this first point that Alvarez makes in his piece, and that's that academia is in crisis. And this is not isolated to academia. It's not a particularly unique phenomenon. It's happening through most fields. But we are in this field, so we're going to talk about this field. Basically, over the past 2 decades, there's been kind of this increasingly corporate corporatization of higher education. So, for example, in 2003, there were only 2 colleges that charged more than $40,000 a year for tuition, fees, room, and board. And then 6 years later, in 2009, more than 200 colleges charged that amount, over $40,000 a year. So what happened between 2003 and 2009, Terrence?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I think that, like we sort of mentioned before, a big contributor to this is the rise of contingent faculty.
Well, yes. And at the same time, though, the motivation.
Oh, you mean the motivation? The recession. Economic crisis.
Yeah, exactly. Crisis. So 2008, you have this massive recession, biggest sort of economic stagnation since the Great Depression.
Don't you love it when you softball like something really easy?
Yeah, and then it's missed. Yeah, it's hard. You know, I'm going to cry about it later, but I'm a professional.
The recession was a really big part of it. So a lot of people, so we know that the economic recession was due in large in part to sort of predatory lending practices and sort of inflated interest rates in the housing market. And so started in sort of the American Southwest, there was this sort of increasing pressure in places like the outside of the city of Las Vegas, for example, where people were like taking loans in these houses. And they started to see very early on that like the bubble was starting to burst and there was some sort of tremors before this earthquake. And then all across the country, people start losing confidence in financial institutions, pulling their money out, and we enter into the Great Recession, as it's so known. And there's a lot of really interesting literature about how we got there and the effects of it. Some would argue that we're still sort of suffering from not just the economic influence of it, but the psychological damage that a recession or a depression can cause on a sort of social level mental state, or the sort of societal level mental state. And that has had a lot of sort of downstream effects, including in industries like academia, which contributes to what I was saying before, this idea of the contingent faculty members, right?
Right. And one of, you know, capitalism writ large, one of the, essentially the only way that profit is generated is by exploiting labor. So paying people less than the value of their labor is worth.
Sure.
So anybody who's worked a 9-to-5 job knows that, you know, you could get a lot of stuff done, but you the amount of work you do in that 9 hours is not going to change the amount of pay that you're on if you're in kind of a contracted work situation.
Right.
And that's that idea that, you know, you have the set amount that you're being paid, but as much work as they can grind out of you, that's right. Better for them because the amount of pay isn't going
to
change.
Right. I mean, one great example is when I used to bartend, right? And so, I mean, obviously there are some exceptions to these rules. So I know that there are people out there who say, well, I work at a place where I do make a salary and then make bonuses per blah, 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 blah. Let's take, for example, bartending for 7 years like I did. You know, the sort of core of the job is what you would expect, making drinks when people come in and counting the money and then going home. But as you take on more and more responsibility, as you've been there longer, your pay doesn't increase. You make the same sort of average tips per evening, something that your employer is not responsible for. Their only job is to pay you beneath the minimum wage. There's a separate minimum wage for those who make who get paid primarily through tips. So they're even pulling even more out of it. But in addition to that, you're expected to, let's say, if the person who's your barback doesn't show up, like you don't get paid more to cover that person's work, but you're expected to know and be able to do that work. Or if someone in the kitchen doesn't show up, you're expected to be that flexible. I'm also daily cutting fruits, sweeping and mopping, responsible for opening and closing the business. I'm also responsible for security. I'm also responsible for helping create things that go onto the menu, which ultimately contribute to the owner, who gets to, at a distance, sort of sit back and say, like, great, this whole machine is sort of running itself, requiring very little intervention on my part. So suddenly, my job goes from I'm making drinks to I am now creating items. I'm preparing the materials for those items. I'm pre-prepping for the rush. I'm cleaning up after the rush. I'm preparing for what's happening tomorrow. In addition to getting things ready for the next person, I'm also responsible for talking to people who want to apply for the job. So I'm the first line of defense in the hiring process.
And but
so
you're still being paid
still
the
being
exact
paid
same amount.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the way that higher ed is achieving this exploitation, they are, as we've talked about before, this idea of contingent faculty. They're hiring more and more people who have less and less job security. And there's a really wonderful podcast that both Terrence and I listen to called Economic Update from a man who used to be a professor named Richard Wolff. And we thought it'd be really great to play this clip from his podcast just about kind of the state, the rise of the adjunct faculty, this contingent worker.
Let's hear what Dr. Wolff has to say.
Today, tenured faculty, represent 17% of college instructors. One out of six has job security. One out of six has a reasonable number of courses so that he or she can spend the time reading, thinking, studying, doing the research that make them an up-to-date, qualified teacher. From 1975 to 2011, Professor Birmingham explains to us, the number of part-time adjuncts, that's the name that's used, people who teach one or two or three courses, or maybe more at multiple universities, typically spending teaching two courses at college number one and one course at college number two and maybe another course at college number three, cobbling together a teaching job, something tenured faculty never had to do. And I was a tenured faculty all of my adult life at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. The case now is that the part-time adjuncts are a majority of the professoriate, a majority of college and universities. Teachers are now part-time adjuncts, and their number is growing faster than anybody else's positions in colleges and universities. And now the statistics you really have to hear to understand. 89% of college adjuncts work at more than one institution. 13% work at four or more institutions. And the reason they work at multiple institutions is obvious. The median pay, that is 50% of adjuncts get more than this and 50% get less. The median pay of an adjunct in the United States, according to a 2014 congressional report, is $2,700 per semester course. Folks, what that means is if an adjunct teaches five such courses, five, two at one university, then runs across town, two at another university, and then runs somewhere else the last day of the week, five at $2,700 a pop, this person earns $13,500 per semester or $27,000 per year.
So now that we've heard what Wolf has to say.
Yeah, I thought that was crazy. That basically if you're working five classes, if you're teaching five classes per term, you're still only going to be making $27,000 a year.
Yeah, yeah. And
that's like what we make right now.
Yeah, and this is the majority of part-time adjuncts who are doing things like this, right? This is an increasing part of the sort of labor market. When you think about what happens after getting your PhD, as an example, and you say, well, I'll do a postdoc or I'll look for an adjunct position or try to find a tenure track faculty position. Oh, man. I mean, they get to pay you less, ostensibly, and they get to hire more of them, and they get on the institutions, and they have a sort of greater wealth of courses being offered. And they also don't have to commit to the kind of contract that they would give to a tenure track faculty member.
Yeah, I was reading, we'll link to it, but I was reading a piece written by a man who is currently an adjunct faculty who's worked for the same institution for 4 years. He works for a couple others as well, but this one in particular, for 4 years he'd worked there. He still doesn't have benefits. He still doesn't have a consistent contract. And basically, he has stopped doing things that are not explicitly part of his job outline. For example, spending extra time beyond his office hours to show a student a test because they wanted to review it. He was like, you know what? Sorry, I'm not getting paid for that. And I can't afford to give you this time that I'm not being compensated for, which is perfectly reasonable.
Yeah. I think the one thing that Wolf sort of advocates for, and I think that is something that we think is kind of one of the ways to fight back against that is this idea of unionization, right?
Right. And now, because had that guy, you know, advocated, like really been vocal about it, we just touched hands. had that guy had been, I'm talking with my hands. Had that guy that I was just speaking about, that non-tenured professor or instructor, had he been really vocal about kind of taking the stand or rocked the boat in any way, he could have been let go.
Oh, yeah, he could have been fired. Yeah. I mean, anybody who's ever worked in a position where they've had to make that choice knows exactly what this particular sort of adjunct is talking about, which is, you know, you're really upset about your working conditions or something that has happened or the way that management has treated you, but you know that the cost of being vocal is also means that you might not be able to feed yourself or pay your rent, and that's a really right. tough choice to make.
Yeah, there's 1.2 million teaching faculty at the higher ed level in the U.S., and only 27% of those are currently organized or part of a union that right. Collectively bargains for their pay, etc. And that definitely has lines that follow public versus private universities. So only 7% of 4-year private colleges have organized labor yeah. forces. And like until last year, graduate students were only able to organize yeah. legally at public institutions. So right now you're seeing this wave of graduate student unionization because we know it's out there.
Yeah. I mean, anybody who's done the work, I think that this, it's interesting. So you're a graduate student. You have really, you've put a lot of your hopes and dreams to this. Your parents and your society has told you, like, listen, you're going to be so successful at graduate school is a way that sort of proves your intelligence, right? You get to enter into this world of scholars sharing scholarship, and you get to ask the big questions and da da da. And so much of your time as a graduate student is taken up by the fact that you have a responsibility to TA, the fact that you, all the little odd jobs that sort of come out of being a part of that environment that you're expected to do. For example, we are very heavily involved in the recruitment process. So we're not being reimbursed, yet we are chauffeuring students around. We are, which we're glad to do, but, you know, hosting people at our homes, sort of taking them out, making sure they have
it's labor,
et cetera. But it is labor, right? And it is labor that regardless of whether we do or do not do it, our baseline salary does not change, right? And so there's this idea that, like, well, let's say you experience mental fatigue, right, or emotional fatigue. There are some places we'll say, hey, you know what, take a day or two and then, like, you know, come back when you're ready. But there are many places where that is not the case. The expectation is that you deal with it and that you sort of continue on. And so it feeds into a lot of these myths that we have about not only what is it like, but what our opportunities are like and what options that we have as graduate students to sort of maneuver within that space.
And that's exactly the next point that Maximilian Alvarez outlines in this piece, and actually in more depth kind of goes into on another piece he wrote for the Chronicle, which is actually, it was a pretty sassy book review that kind of he spun then into this kind of indictment of these myths that we academicians buy into. Mm-hmm. So to give a couple of examples, it's this idea that, for example, you know, you go along with saying, oh, yeah, I read that article, when you either skimmed it or didn't read it at all. And you just pass off the, oh, yeah, like I'm the super reader.
Right.
Or it's, you know, that, you know, foregoing dinner with your partner that night is less important. You know, it's okay to forego it because you have to do this work for your right. mentor that's due tomorrow. And it's the most important thing in the world. And so everything else gets put on hold, and that's fine and normal. Or it's this idea that if you, like you were just saying, if you need an emotional health day, or yeah. if you're struggling with mental health challenge or physical health challenge, if you're needing to deal with that, that's a personal failing.
Right.
And it's something that no one else is experiencing because everybody else has on their shiny, happy faces and they're doing great and their yeah. grades are perfect and they're publishing so much and good job.
Imagine the effect that this has on someone who is, myself included, who you go into it, for example, right? And let's say you sit down in a class, going back to the sort of, I've totally read that point, right? You sit down in a class and you've been working on X, Y, and Z that your advisor and that you're graded the test that you need to grade for your class. And you've also been working on this other long-term assignment. And you have a particular class where they've assigned you 4 articles and then 1 optional article. And they've given you that as your reading for the week. And the expectation is, well, you do it because everybody has had a class with a professor who treats their class like it's the only thing that you have to fucking do.
Which is confusing because they're all mentors as well. Like right, exactly. They all are like telling their kids like, oh yeah, don't pay attention to class because you got to do this shit for me.
So you go into these courses and the discussion continues or begins about some paper, and the teacher asks that open-ended question that says, so what did you guys think about, the way that they did this study? I mean, their analysis is interesting, right? Because, I mean, we don't really see anything else like this in the literature. I don't know. What are your thoughts? And the entire class sits silent. And we've all, if you're a graduate student currently, past or present, you've been in the situation where that question is asked to a room that remains silent. And
literally on Friday, I was in a class and the teacher was like, so you guys didn't read it?
Yeah.
And then we all like scrambled to cover each other's asses because, I mean, I think Alvarez sometimes overstates the fact that there isn't this sort of, at least at the grad student level, there isn't kind of this communal understanding that like we're all kind of just struggling to keep our heads above water.
Yeah, yeah. But it's funny how that, if your perception is that everyone else is getting the work done,
right,
then the feeling that you have because you couldn't prioritize reading this article or making sure that you had it down well enough to be able to discuss it in a nuanced way, the feeling that you are not sort of meeting the bare minimum requirements of you as a graduate student can lead to feelings of failure or disillusionment. And that's really negative, especially when the reality is that most people are also not able to meet those same sort of requirements. So you have a bunch of people who are privately suffering in the collective space, all assuming the other people are doing more work than they are or handling it better than they are, which is really nice. I mean, what myths have you held about academia that you think have been detrimental to your success?
Yeah, I was trying to kind of think about this as we were preparing for this podcast. And I think I certainly have held the idea that certain schools that I perceive to be more prestigious are superior.
Yeah.
And sort of the fact that I'm going to the smaller private school is maybe lesser than, or would have implications for, you know, whatever jobs I might be able to get in the future, right. Which we'll go on and we'll talk about later, but that might be the reality. Yeah. But you know, that idea of like, oh, well, because, you know, I feel like I did everything I could to get into grad school as well as I could. And then maybe I'm not going to the best place. But in reality, if I check that, I am going to the exact place where the perfect person to study under, yeah, who's, you know, hyper focused on the exact thing that I want to do in the way that I want to do it. There's no better place for me to be doing graduate work.
Yeah.
But I still have this lingering kind of, this faculty went to Stanford, this faculty went to Duke. Like,
right,
you know, if I want to go into academia, this school that I'm going to spend 6 years getting an education at is insufficient.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because the, to sort of telltales about sort of my past as well, I had an offer from UPenn, which is an Ivy League. And I remember,
ching, shiny, shiny.
I gotta say, man, the interview at UPenn was like, unlike any of the other interviews that I had in any other schools, because it's very clear, Ivy League makes it very clear when you are in the sort of presence of Ivy League. I mean, and it's it was kind of awe inspiring, and it was very compelling for me at the beginning stages, not really knowing whether or not I would get into any programs, to then go to Philadelphia, a city that I love anyways, and to meet some really like great, well natured people who were other graduate students, and then these like fiercely confident faculty members who were like, this is the best place possible. I had one person ask me directly, yeah, like, what other schools are you applying to? And I was like, oh, you know, I'm thinking about X, Y, and Z. And they're like, yeah, but like, those aren't Penn, you know? Like,
oh my God, graduate, that's so crazy.
Like, when you graduate, they're not going to remember those, you know? Nobody's going to notice that you went to University of, you know, blah, 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 blah in Nova Scotia, you know? No one's going to remember, or no one's going to like notice that you went to the University of like the Upper Peninsula and like Northwest Michigan, you know? But
so they're super far gone on that myth train.
Yeah, but the funny thing is though, that like in that space, the confidence is very much like, yo, you might be right though, you know?
Yeah. It's appealing. It's really appealing. Yeah. Well, yeah, it's seductive and to a certain extent is accurate.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I think that some of these other things, for example, like, okay, this idea that there is, you know, to be successful, you've got to be the strongest individual in the group, right? You publish or you perish. This idea that
right,
if you just focused more, you'd be more productive. The reason that you're not able to juggle 12 things at once isn't because like some outside circumstances or because it's too much work. It's because you're not focused enough, right? Or that the productivity, sort of as a corollary of that, the productivity is really where your value comes from. That is supreme.
Right.
Your ability to produce papers to add to the prestige.
Right, in a very quantitative fashion, rather than, like, especially as I'm someone studying clinical work, like, it isn't that you create one, like, very time and resource intensive study that looks at the effectiveness of an intervention that then when you compare that, which says we discovered something that's going to help people, when you compare that to somebody who published 10 articles in the exact same time that took you to do this really gnarly work, like, you are less than because they have 10 and you have one.
Right. And it's the adage that the author mentions, right? The golden shores of tenure waiting for us. They wait for us if we just swim hard enough.
Right.
If you work hard enough. If you publish enough papers.
Which is so capitalistic in general, just that, like, if you work hard enough, you will get what you want. It's the American dream.
Yeah. So how did we get here?
Well, I think that part of it is it's related to these kind of goals of the type of people and the reasons that they go into academia. So, and the asterisk is now that it's a corporate academia, which I don't think, has been true for the entirety of the existence of academia. So I don't know, you correct me if this is wrong, but I felt like part of, and Alvarez articulates the reasons that people go into academia in their various fields. This looks very different, but generally they want to use their knowledge for public good. They want to produce new knowledge. And they believe that teaching and expanding knowledge can actually make a difference in the
world. Correction for my part, I did not go to graduate school for those reasons.
Why did you go to graduate school?
I mean, well, we've talked about this in previous episodes. So I had the idealism piece, which definitely sort of came more and more later. And especially now, it's a big part of why I want to be in graduate school. But I think initially I was doing what I'm sure that many people do, which is I graduated with my undergrad. And it seemed like the next natural step in order to continue to grab a hold of the sort of that kind of privilege that you get when you have more and more of an education, but also this idea that I had found something that I've been really good at, right? And so I actually had less altruistic goals going to graduate school and more of like, I have worked so many jobs, traveled so many places, and been trying to figure out like what sticks, like what plays to my strengths and what am I actually good at. And then I sort of, my last 2 years of my undergraduate were characterized by a lot of productivity and research, and I felt like a sense of ownership over my work, and I felt more sort of proud and powerful of myself. It was the kind of thing that suddenly when someone asked me, what did you do? I didn't sort of deflect to all of my hobbies. I was like, oh, well, I do this. I work in this lab. I do these things to this lab.
So but you me, definitely want to teach. Like,
Yeah. But again, the teaching wasn't sort of because I thought that, like, well, I'm going to put knowledge out to make the world a better place. It was like, I think that, like, it sort of plays to all of the things that I'm really, really good at. And I would like to teach because of, like, it seems like teacher is the kind of job that suits Terrence really well.
Do you feel like knowledge makes the world a better place?
Well, so, yeah. And I think that as more time went by, I was like, yeah, I would like to be in that position not only to spread knowledge, but also to tell people to drop out if they need to drop out. That's something I believe very strongly. And also to be able to be someone that can be seen, that's visible as a person of color, to be in a faculty position in a field where very few people of color are in faculty positions. I thought there's something very important about, like, that story of like sort of being incarcerated, being homeless, coming from like a low income family and having like your parents sort of work really hard to give you the basic opportunities and then working really hard from there to provide yourself with more meaningful opportunities. And then standing in front of a classroom and saying, hey, like you can do it also. If I can do it, then you can do it also. But also you don't have to be here to be a good person, you know? And so I think those are more of my goals rather than sort of a broad altruism about knowledge or about the importance of an education or about making the world a better place. And I think that those have come later. I do certainly believe those things now, but I think that that's a tangent too far from your original point.
Yeah, well, I think be it sort of this broad altruism or these very specific kind of individual goals. Yeah,
either way, I was wrong.
No, well, yeah, that when you confront those sort of dreams with the reality of what higher education, especially corporate higher education, is presently about, it's not about achieving those dreams for you at an individual level. It's about making money for an institution.
Got money and you know it.
Yeah.
Pocket and show it then, throw it like.
And I love the show Silicon Valley. And I felt like this was like the perfect clip, the one we're about to play for you, that basically is like the mind shattering thing about capitalism is that the point. Well, you'll hear
in the Valley, take it away.
Richard, listen.
No, you listen to me, Jack. You promised me that you would never compromise the product. So, do you feel like taking some action and backing me up on this? Because me and my product feel pretty fucking compromised right now.
Richard, I don't think you understand what the product is. The product isn't the platform. And the product isn't your algorithm either. And it's not even the software. Do you know what Pied Piper's product is, Richard?
Is it me?
Oh, God, no! No! How could it possibly be you? You got fired. Pied Piper's product is its stock.
I just don't think you understand what the product is. The product isn't the platform, and the product isn't your algorithm either. And it's not even the software. Do you know what Pied Piper's product is, Richard?
Is it me?
Oh, God, no. No. How could it possibly be you? You got fired. Pied Piper's product is its stock.
That's funny. All right, well, so if that's not a sort of sobering splash of cold water onto the face of someone who is hoping that academia is actually interested in the academic.
Right, it's not about the production of research. It's not about teaching students. It's about making money for. And like, you know, I went to a private or public undergrad institution, and they were rolling out this like massive fundraising thing. They're a public institution. They should be funded by taxpayers for people in that state to be able to attain higher education. That should be the point, is creating a more educated and capable sort of, in theory, workforce. Gross, but you know, sort of more educated people. But right. That's not the point right. anymore.
And the mythology of higher ed sort of merges seamlessly with this sort of neoliberal ethos of self-reliance and the self-serving fantasies of meritocracy and capitalistic bootstrapism, which sort of loosely defines this idea that, you know, bootstrapism says pull yourself up by the sort of the skin of your teeth or whatever. What's
the laces of your boots?
Laces of your boots. There it is. I was like, what's the thing that relates to boots? But the bootstrap is like a little hook on the back, right? So it's like, you know, grab it and pull yourself up. And the sort of capitalistic version of that says you're a worker and you're working with the limited resources that you do have, but one day you can become the owner. You can become the person who is not the sort of the, you're not the working class now, you're the elite. And it's the sort of,
you get grind. To exploit people now. Yeah. Yay.
You become the exploiter.
Yeah. And I mean, this is that bootstrapism idea is just meritocracy by another name. So this idea that if you work hard enough, you will get what you want.
Right. Which presumes that everybody starts at the same place, among other things.
Oh, man.
And the same opportunities are available to everyone. And that there isn't discriminatory hiring practices, even within academia, which we'll get to in a little bit. But
right. Exactly. So, you know, you have countless studies that will document this in different ways. So be it racial profiling, they'll send out identical resumes for a professor for, you know, a hiring position. And they'll go out either with, you know, the exact same content on the resume, except for the name at the top is either a quote unquote black name or a quote unquote white name.
So a resume with all the same credentials, and one says Sitara Nishalay and the other one says like
John Smith,
then John Smith is much more likely to get hired. And Sitara Nishalay is the name of my cousin. So that's not a name I pulled out of nowhere. You know, it's just that's this idea that if you just happen to be, keep in mind that your name says zero about you in terms of your qualifications or your personality or where you come from or who you are, what your parents
or your productivity or successfulness,
anything. And the idea that we can be sort of passed over on selection just by virtue of that is, you know, something that shouldn't be surprising, but should be disturbing.
And in a broad study that took into account kind of all these factors that could potentially predict whether you were going to be hired into a tenure track position, the single most predictive factor was whether you went to a prestigious grad school.
Right. And keep in mind that some of these same biases are in place at the level of getting into the institution,
right,
not only your graduate institution, but in more quote-unquote prestigious undergraduate institutions. So think about this filtering process that occurs at every level of the system. It's harder to get into college in the first place. It's more difficult for you to transition from undergraduate to graduate school, where the pool is even smaller. And then even further from that, it's harder to get into a faculty position, even an adjunct position, based off of some of the same kinds of criteria that are in place at the lower levels of the academic hiring process. So who makes it to the top, but the most productive, the most quote-unquote productive, rather, the most quote-unquote successful, but also these people who don't necessarily possess a lot of variety, that gets filtered out at the lower levels, you know, a variety of experience, variety of culture, variety of language and thought, and sort of political ideation and family history. And so, you know, that it's this thing that like becomes more and more problematic. And then we ask ourselves the question, well, how do we find more diversity in faculty, right?
Right, which I was thinking about, you know, we have this, like at our school, we have this huge push of this diversity and inclusive excellence.
They all do.
Thing. They definitely do. They all call them something fancy and different. But I have never heard people talk about diversity of sort of academic source, or, you know, like that where you're coming from in terms of your background. It's like, Okay, well, if they look a certain way or they have a certain set of experiences, that's the diversity we care about. Not, you know, and if they come from an Ivy, that's all the better, because probably that's the person we're going to hire.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, because then you get into an entirely separate conversation about how diversity is valued. And we think about sort of which is the more profitable diversity.
And that's so good.
And like, you know, and there's something really sort of cynical about that, right? And that like the...
Because if it enhances your brand to have like the black kid and the woman in the hijab and the white kid all studying when they're lying with their heads facing each other on the grass,
sure,
and on your quad,
right,
like if that shot can go on your publishing materials, that enhances your brand in some way, because it's culturally relevant at this particular moment in time.
Yeah.
But what substantively does that add necessarily? We don't even know if those aren't actors.
Right. Or that we don't, there are a lot of things that are diversity in and of itself. We kind of touched on it a little bit in our episode with Hannah, and I think it's definitely something worth coming back to, because the idea is not to sort of say, well, it's wrong like sort of value the experience or the presence of someone who might come from an underrepresented background, whether it's a racial or religious or sexual or whatever the case is background. There's still this notion that the way that we approach the conversation about diversity is potentially a problematic.
Like, what are the motivations behind it? That's the important piece.
Exactly.
And the sort of practical implications for the people who are living those experiences.
So the combination of academics.
So when the reasons that you get into academia, those kind of goals we talked about, combine with these kind of myths that you just kind of grind it out. Mm-hmm. And that makes us, as we talked about at the beginning, that makes academics, academics in training, they're uniquely sort of primed for this exploitative process.
Yeah. And to quote Alvarez, he says, the notion that we're expected to sacrifice our fundamental well-being for the vocation we love keeps us silent in the face of outrage and outrageous workplace abuses. It's even cynically manipulated by the university administrative class to instill in us a perpetual gratitude for getting to be here in the first place. If we love what we do, we're told over and over that should be compensation enough. In this placid paternalist view of things, everything else from health benefits to fair wage compensations is more or less a bonus. The only adequate reply to such managerial sonorities, is
bullshit. Yeah, I mean, I like how Stassi Alvarez gets in this piece. He's because it's kind of this psych up to like really combat. I mean, when I was thinking about like the idea that when you're a grad student or a faculty member and you're just grinding away and you've got to, you know, achieve X, Y, and Z goals, and they just kind of keep coming and keep coming, like, it's exhausting to think about having to go home at 5 or 6 o'clock and make dinner and then go back out and try to get everybody to come together and collectively organize. Like,
yeah. And that's the great thing about the union, the idea of like, I mean, in a future episode, we'll get into, we'll have a more in-depth discussion about graduate student union specifically. So please stay tuned for that. But I think that there is something really, you know, we talk about this sort of thing and it's hard, you know, even as someone who, tries to in living through their own values and ideas, it's hard sometimes to make that space. I mean, I tell my advisor and have told him a number of times, like, I think that grades are bullshit. And I think that this idea of like pushing to meet X deadline arbitrarily is kind of bullshit. And I think that it like doesn't serve me. And I've expressed those ideas and they're not popular ideas. And he says, well, your grades should be important. And like, he's entitled to say that. And I'm entitled to have my own beliefs.
Right.
For better or for worse, like, you have some level of security once you get into a PhD program. Like, you got to do a lot before they sort of kick you to the curb, at least in some of the more like maybe social sciencey liberal programs, perhaps. But the, you know, I try to advocate for myself in those small ways to sort of say, to push back against this idea that like, yeah, everything that I do and your expectations of me and like this whole jumping to the hoops thing, like that has to be a consensual process. And like to the point that it stops like serving me or leads to like really unhealthy outcomes, then I'm on your side. But as soon as we cross that line, then I've got to, you know, give you some of that pushback. But it is tiring work and it can be the kind of thing that's exhaustive and you can become quickly very jaded. And, you know, I think that one solution is unionization, but some other, I think, more hopeful things that we can do as sort of in response to that, you know, include like sort of thinking about what we should be moving towards, what higher ed should be. I mean, how would you articulate this, Naomi?
Well, I don't need to articulate it because a wonderful author over at Jacobin magazine wrote this piece kind of about this very idea, but that academia and higher ed should strive to be, quote, a democratic institution in which the people involved in this institution, whoever they are, faculty, students, staff, participate in determining the nature of the institution and how it runs. And he kind of has an aside that that should be the same for a factory or any kind of workforce.
Sure.
That's this idea of this democratic workplace. And I think that that is something that we should be working for. And as you alluded to, I think that communal organizing and kind of collectivizing our power of the many is one of the only tools we have to do that.
I mean, you see that at a societal level too. I mean, why are people protesting? Why did Obama's aides like echo each other's thoughts and then sort of reattribute them to their source? You know, why do we engage in some of these sort of like sort of take these team-based approaches to problem solving? Is because, you know, throughout American history and throughout world history, there's a sort of recognition that sort of collectively we have more strength than we do, you know, and it requires a sort of collective, a bunch of people who you don't have to be, have all the same ideas and beliefs. We can, theoretically, we can all agree that like, hey, we think our lives should be, you know, sort of more fair. Although fair is an interesting concept, this idea that like we shouldn't allow ourselves to continue being exploited in a way that makes us uncomfortable, particularly when that exploitation doesn't necessarily serve us any better. People are holding letters of recommendation hostage, even though there is no direct or indirect contribution oftentimes to some of the extracurricular labor that you do. If you ask anybody who's finished their grad program, aside from some like fond memories and the bonds they made with other graduate students through that duress, you know, like how is killing yourself every day serving you in the long run? So, you know.
Yeah. And I think one of the ideas that are sort of myths that comes up for me and when I kind of think about this is like, well, you know, I have it pretty good. I'm making okay money. You know, as far as grad students go, I'm like really comfortable and I haven't thus far been pressed to do things that I, you know, feel like is sort of beyond what's reasonable. Why should I try to unionize or, you know, collectively sort of organize? And I think that that's not reasonable. That's sort of playing into that you're lucky to be here, don't rock the boat mentality. So for example, one of my mentors is an undergrad right now. She's this brilliant person and she did this systematic review through kind of getting some back channel because it's a public institution. She was able to gain access to everyone's pay, all of the faculty, and she did a gender comparison. And so she is one of the longest, the people who's been a faculty member the longest longest, over 20 years, but she's being paid less than male colleagues who were hired just a handful of years ago. Mm. And so she's suing our university, which is awesome. But a lot of the feedback she gets, you know, in these gross online comment situations are, you don't, you know, why is she asking for more money? Because she already makes so much.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, but she's asking to be reasonably compensated for labor that she's doing.
Yeah.
Not even compensated at to the level of what it's worth, but to be compensated on par with her male colleagues.
Yeah. And the sad thing I think about the story is that it is something that probably wouldn't have changed had she not gained access to that information.
Right. Right? Which is kind of the cool thing. Like, that was research.
Yeah.
Research has power. And yeah, so I think that not only is it important to kind of have these sort of actions in real life, but on a day-to-day basis to try to challenge kind of the way that these myths are being reified through our actions and, you know, the requests of supervisors, etc.
And we have many opportunities as people, as graduate students, to talk very candidly to, I mean, whether it's during the recruitment process, whether it's to faculty, whether it's to other graduate students, you know, to be very vocal about this idea that, like, hey, it's hard, you know, and to, you know, don't force yourself to buy into some of these different ideas about, like, what should or shouldn't be, you know. Acknowledge the sort of validity in your own experience and say that, like, this is not, number one, abnormal, you know. And that goes to a lot of these things we've talked about before. I mean, you know, this idea that, you know, whether it's the sort of working too much or whether it's the expectation of being focusing sort of resulting in better outcomes, even if it stresses you the hell out, or the idea that you should be killing yourself and prioritizing your work above friends, family, and all others, you know, like, pushing back against some of those myths, because you are in a position of power as a graduate student to those people who are not yet graduate students and to other graduate students. You become the media in a sense, right? Yeah,
I think another idea that Alvarez forwards is this idea of including and valuing the scholarly work of the precariat. So people who aren't tenure track faculty should be part of research, should be part of publishing, should be part of that knowledge generation idea. And I think that goes to this kind of idea of creating new ways, like we alluded to before, like a lot of academic research being behind a paywall, creating new ways of producing and disseminating knowledge that is no less scientifically rigorous, but that is more democratic, is more accessible to people. It's enabling them to fuel their resistance to the powers that are constraining their daily lives.
I mean, and it's also the idea, I think, rolled into that. There is a big push, you know, to have, you know, to be first author on a paper and to have, you know, like, you know, you and one other person, or just you as sort of like the gold standard, like you just by yourself. But I think that there is a way to be more inclusive in research that sort of is also sort of serves the goal of being more interdisciplinary, which I think is a problem in the field, but
as well as more participatory.
Yeah, exactly.
So including representatives of the populations that you are studying. It might be hard if you're in biology, like a frog probably can't be the author. But if you're in human research, you know, if you are working with, for me, for example, a population, yeah, I'm pretty funny. But so if you're working with women who've experienced sexual assault, is it taboo for a woman who's been through that experience, who's informing your research from the very beginning, to also be an author? I don't think so. I think that should be the norm.
Yeah. I mean, those are some interesting conversations, right? Because then we should talk more, I think, as a discussion about like this idea of representation in research, because I think that there's some very nuanced things to say about that. So save your emails in case you're like, well, I think that this, because we probably agree with you. But to sort of continue on as we approach the end of the episode, what are some other things that, actually, let me ask you this question. First, I have two quotes from Alvarez. Mm-hmm. The first relevant to this, right? So our first quote, talking about the sort of deconstruction of myths, says, the work of organizing and bargaining can and must be extended to include concerted campaigns to reorient disciplines we're in the process of sustaining and the nature of academic work itself. So it's sort of paraphrase, it's like, we have to engage in the work, right? You know, mm-hmm. And we have to change the nature of academia. And it's kind of up to us, right?
Yeah, that organizing is not only about, you know, achieving adequate health care and work compensation, but it's also about fundamentally changing the type of work we do and the way in which we do it.
Right. Now, what do you think Alvarez meant by this quote? We need to encourage more self-reflective research that makes a deliberate effort to explode the imbalance of knowledge at the point of its production. Emerging cohorts of scholars can carve out a new trajectory for thoroughly communal forms of scholarship with many authors and seek out and learn from such experimental scholarship that already exists.
Yeah, that I was sort of both struck by the sort of striking call to action there, but also, you know, wondered kind of what this experimental research, this cutting edge stuff that he was talking about. So it made me think of, so in our field of in clinical psychology, there's a lot of exciting work being done in the area of autism or ASD research. And so because a lot of the research is done with very particular genetic mutations right now, because it's such a heterogeneous disease, there are these very particular genetic mutations of folks who they are looking to study, and these are few and far between. So the way that these researchers have found to sort of approach this is by banding together all across the United States at different institutions, even across the world, and sort of, you know, putting together their heads and collecting research in these various areas for the purpose of understanding a disease better and promoting sort of understanding of the best ways forward for the people who are experiencing these disorders.
Yeah.
And so this is this really cool consortium work that feels like it's kind of violating, like you're saying, the prestige of the individual, the promotion of one person as the expert. And it's privileging the actual product, the producing research that's going to have this impact.
Yeah. And, you know, I take it, that's interesting, because the way I kind of integrated into my thoughts about academia and about how we sort of construct research, sort of thought about it as like, there are places around the country that do a better job in some cases of having sort of diversity of experience thought that sort of better fulfilling that promise, and are, I think, are a little bit closer to some of the, like, the original intentions of academia, maybe. And you often sort of see them on the fringes. They're usually not the people who are, like, main stage talking at a conference about some big body of research they've done, or at least they're not necessarily those individuals. And I think that building bridges between those different kinds of institutions, making networks, and sort of seeking out, when you go to this conference, say, like, that's a cool idea, we should work on that together, or this idea that you stop prioritizing your citations and stop sort of generating your main points from articles published by the most famous authors that have been cited the most in the most in the top journals in the country. I mean, I often hear that from advisors where they say, we want to make sure that this gets into a good journal, or when going and picking citations, saying, no, well, look, no one's ever heard of that journal, so let's not use those citations, or like da-da-da-da, as if somehow their science is less valid than the science done by some of these bigger schools that are more famous for their work. And I think that that's actually a deeply problematic thing that happens at the level in the lab, one-on-one, when the people in leadership say, well, I see that you've got the sort of Journal of South American Economic Behavior here, but like that, no one cares about that. Or I see you've got the sort of German Journal of North, like sort of regional psychology in front of you, but we're really sort of focused on scholarship coming out of the United States or whatever it is. And those kinds of biases that are often sort of instructed and sort of pushed on you just so casually. It's so the assumption is just built in, like, No. We have to. I want you to go, and I want you to find their impact score, and which is really an indicator of like how many people read it and how many citations, mm-hmm. articles, and those things get. So ostensibly a popularity contest, and we're going to say, well, we're only going to pull from the highest impact journals. So now we're a part of this sort of machine that sort of only feeds back into itself.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think, you know, as a sort of budding clinician, I was thinking about this idea in the way of like reframing these myths that we sort of buy into as academicians.
I like that you say academicians. And previously, I would have said just academics.
Academics. I don't know what the difference is.
I think it's because
it gets multisyllabic, and then I'm like, I'm not really sure what the word is. But I like this idea. So Alvarez says, when there's no space for new or different knowledge, we make it. And I feel like that's using one of the sort of fundamental myths that most people buy into of like, you know, this idea of like knowledge generation is good and cool. And like, we are, you know, we are first and foremost, the servants of the data or the findings, and what those indicate that we should do rather, and that sort of gives us the fuel to buck these sort of systemic impositions from the outside,
yeah.
that these higher sort of callings or goals or the reasons we got into in the first place, are both the motivation and the mechanisms for a way forward.
Exactly. And sort of building off of that, I think that I think in saying that you kind of touch on the key part of it. I mean, because Alvarez mentions sort of way back in the beginning, this idea that we had this idea of graduate school being a place where it's about knowledge, it's about the research, we love this stuff, et cetera, et cetera. Making it more about that, you know, celebrating like that part of the process, right? And not giving so much glory to the sort of the production side of it, you know? And yeah. Also celebrating teachers and celebrating individuals who work in labs and the undergraduates who contribute to that work and making space for them and making space for people at different institutions, you know, we have to engage in the work, right? And yeah. It sounds like that's the
important. We'll close out with this beautiful quote from the end of Alvarez's piece. The more we act in our daily professional lives as if we are not already embroiled in this ongoing crisis, the more we surrender both strength and power to the forces that are destroying what we love. And I feel like he really ends with this call for us fighting for what we love. And I feel called to action, and I will definitely be sort of looking for both the kind of tiny ways I can do this on a daily basis. And, you know, I'm in contact with some national organizing folks and looking for ways that we can maybe do this on a larger scale as well.
Nice. And, you know, and for my part, you know, after reading it and digesting it and having this discussion, I'm not convinced. So I think I'm pretty content with the status quo. So. And that's all for this discussion.
Terrence just joins the rank of the administrators. Absolutely. And drives a stake in my heart.
I'm very interested in being the administrator. I've lived a life of exploitation. I just want to be the one pushing the button. All right? I want to be with the one with the boot on the throat. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because I get to look at the sky, you know. I get to have boots at that point. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, I'm just trying to get to a place where like, I can have lots of stuff. People respect me. People like me.
And you just kind of crush people daily,
I don't care.
Step on their throats and squish around.
Who helped me along the way, where I got the leg up from. It's not important. I don't care what people have to step on to get to my
dreams.
That
makes a lot of sense, you know?
If the pyramid that I stand atop of is made up of the corpses of grad students, you know what? That's fine.
I think it was in a different piece. I did a lot of reading last night. That's one of the cool bits about Alvarez's pieces that he links to just like a ton of really awesome material. But somebody referenced in World War Z where there's like all the zombies trying to get over wall, and they just they basically the corpses build up until a few are able to actually get over the wall.
It becomes a ramp.
But I think that's not, you know, perhaps going to be the situation as, you know, we build on the work of previous generations of academic activists. But it's going to be important to both acknowledge their presence and build on their work in meaningful ways.
Yeah. And so to you, the listener, I think that you are part of this, right? You are part of this community. And so by virtue of being a sort of thinking, conscientious person who is also interested in their own big questions and their own goals as a person who has sort of taken that plunge and decided I'm going to go to graduate school because this is how I get to the next step in my life. This is how I push forward my dreams. This is how I push forward my goals. You know, you are a part of this community. This whole space, Graduates Anonymous, Naomi and myself, we are here as individuals who want to be a part of the community, not as leaders or as da-da-da, but just sort of individuals who say like, hey, these discussions are important, and if you haven't been listening to them, here's what they are. And we'd love to know how you feel. Write us in the comments on the page. Shoot us a message on Twitter. Hit us up on the email. You know, just whatever, however you want to reach out. Like, hey, I agree with you. Or, hey, I disagree with you. Or I think this is how we do it better. Or I think that Alvarez is full of shit. Or I think that, like, you know, you guys are full of shit. Or I think that you guys hit it right in the nail on the head. It's not about being right. It's not about being the most just, but we think that as a community, you know, that we include all of you in, that we want to be having these conversations and we want to have that dialogue. And hopefully all of us sort of come up together, right? And that's the point. And in doing so, we like to give you just a little something to end your week with, you know, a little something that you can take home and chew on outside of the discussion, something we like to call Wrecks of the Week.
So my wreck of the week, I finally, as somebody who's in a child clinical psychology program, I finally watched Inside Out, the animated film about sort of the emotions inside of a young girl's mind.
Yes.
And they're anthropomorphized, so they kind of each represent a particular emotion and interact and have kind of the inner workings of her mind. And it was really cute, and I feel like it will be really useful for teaching children and adults about their feelings. And because one of the kind of big things about I feel like one of the failings of our society is that we aren't very good about talking about or recognizing our own emotions. So
I hear that when you watch Inside Out, there's a clip on YouTube, but it's like Inside Out with the inside parts taken out. So it's just,
it's just her life from the outside. Yeah, I've heard of that too. Yeah,
apparently it's very good. It's like very touching because, I mean, the premise of the movie, as sort of Naomi mentioned, is that it really sort of tells two stories in parallel, the story of the little girl moving to a new town with her mom and dad, and then also her sort of developing emotionally as her emotions sort of are dealing with all these changes. And so you kind of get the sort of two sides of the same coin, and they're both really interesting, and they make the movie sort of in totality very charming. But someone had the idea to sort of take and sort of edit out all of the inside bits and just show you the outside parts. And what you get as a result is the story of like a young girl who moves to a city with her parents and has to deal with some of their changing lives as their parents have different responsibilities and they're in a new environment in school. And like, they're just lingering shots where it's like, she feels sad and the camera pans out and then it's like her in school the next day. And it's like, man, this is some real stuff.
Yeah. No, that's funny. I'm imagining what it would be. I kind of want to watch that. What's your wreck of the week?
That's a good question. I would say that if I had to continue to procrastinate and come up with an answer to this question. No. So Master of None is a show by Aziz Ansari. If you've never seen it, the first season of it is on Netflix. It's really...
So is the second season.
Well, yeah, I'm just letting them know sort of...
Okay. You're giving background. I was putting the cart before the horse. My bad. I'm learning how to host.
It's the show about... it's all good, man. We're here together. We're doing it. It's a core team. But the first season really sort of... tread some of the ground about being this guy who's a millennial for all intents and purposes in his 20s or 30s. I'm not sure if they exactly say how old he is.
I feel like millennials are getting older and older.
That's true. We are.
People are no, just that like the range of, because it's like cool to be a millennial. So people will be like, oh yeah, I was born in 75 and I'm a millennial.
I think it's like if you're born in the 80s, like 80 plus. Because, like, being born in the 80s doesn't mean you're an 80s, like, kid, right? Because if you're born in the 70s, then you're an 80s kid, right? Because you were sort of coming of age when, like, stuff in the 80s that we think of emblematic as the 80s is happening. But, like, I'm a millennial and I was born in 86, right?
The internet says 1982 to 2004.
See, that's what I thought. I was like, I feel like it's early 80s. And then it goes through into, like, just post the millennium, which is where I think the name comes from. Or the Willennium, if you're my family and you mom like Will Smith like mine did. But the point is, it's a story about this guy lives in New York City, and it's a really kind of like sobering and very genuine, or it feels very genuine sort of anthology where it's these different moments, these different vignettes from this guy's life as he is trying to date and is hanging out with friends and is dealing with work and identity and living in this big city. And the second season of that show just came out, and it's everything I've heard about it is really awesome. I haven't had a chance to really binge watch the whole thing yet, but I've seen the first episode and it's off to a great start. So I would recommend Master of None season 2 for those of you who are either fans of season 1 or are just looking for a show that is feels like a bit of a slice of life that you can relate to. And maybe you need that in your life right now, especially.
And the really annoying girlfriend from season 1 is out.
Ah.
I very much dislike that character.
Well, spoiler alert, jeezy crazy. And also my second recommendation.
I mean, maybe she comes back. I haven't watched it all, so yeah. Who knows?
She might. You never know.
I haven't. Yeah. She's
like
not there yet.
Mother, where it's like, did they make a decision and then 7 episodes later they're like, just kidding. Every Frame of Painting is my second recommendation. It's a YouTube series. It is initially it was sort of this idea about writing essays about film and then publishing videos that sort of were narrated by those essays. And it sort of evolved through Patreon into this really great way to analyze the form of film and looking at the different ingredients, how picture and sound both work together to create meaning. So if you think of film as language, and if you're interested in sort of the deep analysis of film, Every Frame of Painting is a really interesting series of video essays that take elements of film and deconstruct them and try to have a meaningful conversation about them. And for all fans of film or all fans of literature, I would suggest taking a look at this series because it is it's pretty nice.
I'm super into that. That sounds cool.
Yeah. And so I think that as we usually do, we're going to end this episode with a bit of help wanted. You know, each episode we'd like to bring to you a little bit of information, a little bit of research, a little bit of answers and advice to some of the questions that you might have about what graduate school is and what this is all supposed to be like. However, we also want to hear from you, and we want to know, you've heard this message, in what ways do you think that you'll try to resist? What ways might you want to, but maybe you don't have the space to yet? What things do you think that need to change about academia? We want help in answering those questions, so reach out to us however you feel comfortable, whether it's through email, whether it's through our website at gradanon.fireside.fm, whether it's through our Twitter at gradanon, whether you can leave us a comment on iTunes or Google Play or Stitcher, all of which our podcasts are located on, or you just want to visit us on the web and type in Graduates Anonymous and go into it, open a forum on Reddit and just be like, these guys suck, or these are my ideas about the resistance.
Oh, one day if we are that famous to be Redditified. I will give a shout out to Jimmy on Twitter. I won't give out his handle because privacy, but we're anonymous. But Jimmy, he hit us up. He gave us a really cool idea for a new podcast topic, and we're gonna try and see if Jimmy will come on. So look forward to that and some other exciting stuff coming up. We have definitely a guest lined up for next week.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of future episodes, I would say look forward to the fact that we are about to enter into the love duo. So we're going to have one episode featuring a guest who talks about being single in graduate school, and the second person who comes in and tells us a little bit about finding love in graduate school. And we think those will be a really interesting series. Also, in the future, we're going to do an episode about student unions, hopefully, and we'll talk about the relationship between graduate students and alcohol. So if any of those things sound interesting to you, stay tuned. Graduates Anonymous is just going to keep getting better as we keep having these conversations with you guys. So thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.
Child, things are gonna get easier. Ooh, child, things will get brighter. Ooh, child, things are gonna get easier. Ooh, child, things will get brighter. Someday, yeah, put it together and we'll get it
done. Maybe it's like hopeful, but in a way that is like naive, you know? It's got you looking at the sun when shit's happening on the ground, you know? Should we be looking at the sun? Things are gonna get easier. They might get harder. This belief that things are gonna get easier is exactly what's holding us up. People expecting the world to get easier. Donald Trump went out on the speech in front of the National Guard and said, you know what? You're going through some hard times right now, but it's okay. Everything will work out, and everything might not work out. You know what song I'm gonna play instead? Yo. Podcast listeners, fuck that. This is your anthem. I want you to just like hear this and know that, like, you know, we're in this together. We're gonna fight.
it's my life I has to fight, nigga. Oh, it's my life, hard times like, yeah. Bad trips like, yeah. Nazareth, I'm fucked up, homie, you fucked up. But if God got us, then we gon' be alright. And when I wake up, I recognize you looking at me for the pay cut. Bahamas, I be looking at you from the face down. One Mac 11, even boom with the bass down. Skimming, and let me tell you about my life. Painkillers only put me in a twilight. With pretty pussy and Benjamin is the highlight. I tell my mama I love her, but this what I like, Lord knows. 20 of them in my Chevy, tell them all to come and get me. Reaping everything I sow, so my karma come in heaven. No preliminary hearings on my record. I'm a motherfucking gangster, and silence for the record. Tell the world I knew it's too late. Boys and girls, I think I've gone crazy. Trying to sign my faces all day. Won't you please believe when I say, when you know we've been hurt, been down before. Nigga, when our pride was low, looking at the world like, where do we go? Nigga, and we hate po-po, wanna kill us dead in the street for sure. Nigga, I'm at the preacher's door. My knees getting weak and my gun might blow, but we gon' be alright.